motivational introduction last time. And basically, the way I'm going to try to organize the course is to spend this week talking about accelerating the convergence of series that are already convergent, that is, extracting the answer from a series. And this is a very, very serious topic. We're going to start off with some lighthearted stuff, Shanks and Richardson and things like that. And you'll get a feeling of the power of what it is that I'm talking about. But then we're going to do something quite serious, and that is we're going to talk about Fourier series. It's my experience that although almost everybody has seen Fourier series, let me ask it the right way. How many of you have not seen Fourier series? Almost nobody. Okay, almost nobody. Okay, so you've seen Fourier series, but it's my opinion that almost nobody understands Fourier series, and that they're taught terribly. And the problem with Fourier series is that they converge very, very slowly. And it turns out that it's not a problem. That's the good thing about Fourier series, because it means that they can be used to solve, they're very powerful, and they can be used to solve extraordinarily difficult problems, okay? But the difficulty that has to be overcome is that when you use a Fourier series to solve a difficult problem, the problem is to get the answer out of the Fourier series. The Fourier series converges to the answer, but it does so slowly that you might as well not bother to ever add up a Fourier series. You should never attempt to actually add up a Fourier series. So you have to extract the answer from the Fourier series without actually adding up the series. Okay, so that's what I mean by acceleration of convergence. Then next week, we're going to talk about divergent series. And I will explain to you how to sum a divergent series and how to extract physical information. And one of the very interesting topics we're going to cover is why it is that a divergent series is divergent. And maybe we'll spend some time, I gather you understand Feynman diagrams, so maybe I will show you the connection between Feynman diagrams and divergent series, and why Feynman series of Feynman diagrams, series of sums of Feynman diagrams, why those series are always divergent, and what to do about it. Okay, so let's address a couple of quick elementary topics. But I want to do this because I want you to get an understanding of just how powerful the techniques are that I'm going to be talking about. So there are two kinds of series that I would like to that are convergent series that I would like to discuss. One of them is a series like, say, the sum 1 minus a half plus a third. Okay, that series. And you know that this series is equal to the log of 2. Okay? So this is an alternating series, and it's a very, very slowly convergent alternating series. If you let your computer run all night and try to sum up these terms in the series, you'll never get a decent representation of the log of 2. Okay? The other kind of series is a non-alternating but slowly converging series. And a typical example is what is called zeta of 2, okay, which is 1 plus a quarter plus a ninth plus, and so on. This is the sum of 1 over n squared. Okay, and we know that this is pi squared over 6. Okay, these are two very different kinds of series. One of them is an alternating series. One of them is a series of terms all having the same sign, but both series are extremely slowly convergent. Okay? And what we're going to use is
a Shanks.
We're going to use a Shanks transformation to sum that series, and we're going to use something called Richardson extrapolation. Both of these techniques, both of these techniques are extremely powerful and useful. And you should learn them, and you will use them for the rest of your life. They are really, really important techniques. Have any of you heard of them? You have. Okay, one person has. You've heard of Richardson. Do you know what it is? Oh, good. Okay, but do you know what it is? No. Wait, you're saying yes, but you're saying no. All right. Okay, so let's talk about Shanks. The point in general, when you're summing a series, the series has the form, the sum of, let's say, A sub n. Okay? And what I will define for you is the partial sum of the series, okay? Say the sum up to capital N, maybe from 0 or from 1, something like this. And we'll call this S sub n. This is the partial sum of the series. And you understand what it means for a series to converge. This is a convergent series. This is a convergent series. And what does it mean for a series to converge? It means that S sub n approaches a limit, okay, which we could call S infinity, as n goes to infinity. If the partial sums of the series approach a limit, a limiting value, okay, then the series has a sum, and the sum is equal to S infinity. The only thing is that the series may take forever to get there. That's the problem. Okay? So, for example, in this case, what does the partial sum do? If you were to calculate the partial sums, each time you add on a positive number, the partial sum goes up. Each time you add on a negative number, it goes down. And if you make a plot of the partial sums as a function of n, what they're doing is oscillating about the correct answer. But they're never getting, they're taking forever to get close to the correct answer. So that's typically what the partial sums are doing. Okay, and we have to do something about this. In this case, it is as if you have a bathroom scale, and you want to know how much you weigh. So you jump onto the bathroom scale, and the scale goes boing, 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 and you sit there for an hour, and it's still oscillating about the correct answer. You don't know what you weigh. Okay, so we have to do something about that. So what Mr. Shanks said was, suppose we make a model. Let's assume that the partial sum, S, has a very simple form. Let's suppose it has the form A plus B times C to the n. OK? So we're thinking of C as being a negative number, OK? And it's a number we're imagining as a model that C is a negative number less than 1, OK? And that as n goes to infinity, because C is in absolute value less than 1, because it's negative, it's oscillating. Okay? It's getting bigger than A and smaller than A and so on. And because it's less than 1, eventually this guy is going to go to 0. And so the sum will approach, Sn will approach A. That would be the limit. Okay? But it's taking a long time to get there because of this oscillatory behavior. So Mr. Shanks says the following. Of course, this isn't the exact this here is not the exact behavior of the partial sums of this series. Okay, that's just a model. Okay, it's just a model. But Mr. Shanks says, great, we don't care what the number B is. That's just a constant. We don't care what the number C is. That's just a constant. We want to know A. So therefore, It's trivial to calculate A. We have three unknowns, A, B, and C, so we need three equations. And the three equations that we should take are three partial sums. So for example, let's take the nth partial sum here. Let's write it down here. Here's the nth partial sum. Let's subtract A from it. Can you see this? Is this too low? OK. Subtract A from it, and this is equal to B times C to the n. Let's take the n minus first partial sum, Sn minus 1 minus A. That's B, C to the n minus 1. And let's take the n plus first partial sum, which is B, C to the n plus 1. OK? Now, suppose we take these two equations and take the ratio of the middle equation divided by the top equation. If I do that, then B will cancel out. OK? So you can see that Sn minus A divided by Sn minus 1 minus A is equal to C. Okay? But if we take the bottom two equations and we divide the middle equation into the bottom equation, what do we get? We get Sn minus A into Sn plus 1 minus A. And both of these are equal to C. Who cares about C? We don't care about C. So this, we'll just forget C. These guys are equal to each other. So all we have to do is solve for A. But of course, you can see how to, I mean, this is just a single equation for A. And if I cross multiply, I will get a quadratic equation for A. And all I have to do is solve. But in fact, something wonderful happens. If I cross multiply, the form of this equation is Sn squared minus 2a Sn plus a squared. And I multiply here, I get Sn plus 1 times Sn minus 1 minus a times Sn plus 1 plus Sn minus 1 plus a squared. And although this is a quadratic equation for a, the a squared cancels. So this couldn't be more wonderful. Okay? This is just, you cancel off the a squared. And we have a linear equation for a. So the solution is unique. Okay? And let's write down the formula for a. Okay? So, I don't know. Let's put the a over here. So we have 2Sn, or let's put the a over here and divide it out. So we have a. This is 2Sn minus Sn plus 1 minus Sn minus 1. And that is equal to Sn squared minus Sn plus 1 Sn minus 1. And this is the formula for a. OK, that's it. Very straightforward, very, very simple. OK, now, A is, of course, not going to be the sum of the series unless the partial sums of the series really have this model form. If the partial sums really do have this form, then, of course, this is the sum of the series. But in general, the sums don't have that exact form. That would be too much to hope for. However, the claim is that if we do this calculation, if we take the partial sums of the series and we make this combination of the partial sums, then we will find that these A's, the claim is that these A's will be much, much closer to the sum of the series. The A's will not be constants, but typically the A's will be oscillating with a much, much smaller amplitude. Okay? So what Mr. Shanks finally says is, let's see, where's the eraser here? Oh. Okay, so what Mr. Shanks says finally is, he says, let's perform what is called a Shanks transformation. So the Shanks transformation, we'll use the letter capital S for Shanks transformation, okay? And we will take the partial sum, it's a Shanks transformation of the sequence of partial sums, okay? So it is, just to copy it, Sn squared minus Sn plus 1 minus Sn minus 1 divided by 2Sn minus, this is not a minus sign, this is just a product, 2Sn minus Sn plus 1 minus Sn minus 1. This is called a Shanks transformation. So what you do is you use the partial sums, and what you get is a new sequence called, we could call this Tn or something like that. Okay? What do you suppose Mr. Shanks says then? He looks at the T's and he says, ah, these numbers are oscillating with a much smaller amplitude. What should I do? Do it again, of course. So then we calculate the Shanks transformation of Tn, and we will get a new sequence. Okay, we can call that Un, and then Vn, and so on. And we can continue this process, okay, and see what happens. Yeah?
If you do the transformation, you get Tn, then Tn, I thought, was the sequence, not series.
The Shanks transformation is a transformation of sequences. Okay, we begin with the sequence of partial sums, and we are trying to get to the limit of that sequence as fast as possible. So again, the model, what we are saying is, let us model this sequence by something of the form A plus B times C to the N. Okay, and we end up with a new sequence, and then we do it again and again and again. Okay, so the question is, what happens? Let's see what happens. Okay. Oh, before I show you, just one remark. You notice that we needed three equations, because there were three unknowns, A, B, and C. Okay? So just to make it a little bit more explicit here, what Mr. Shanks would say is, make a Shanks table. So what is a Shanks table? This is n, just the number n, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And he would say, first of all, write down the partial sums of the series whose sum you're trying to find, okay? So you put the entries in this table here, okay? Then he would say, here are the t sub n's. Now, from these three numbers here, I can calculate that T sub n. From these three numbers here, I can calculate that T sub n. So if I make a Shanks table, suppose I put six terms in the partial sum, then you understand I can calculate four of the T's. And from these four T's, I can then calculate these are the U sub n's. Okay, so I can calculate two U's, and that's all I can calculate. Of course, if I had another term in the series, in the partial sums, then that means that I would have one more of these and one more of these, and then I could calculate one V. Okay? Is that clear? You all understand? So I can make a Shanks table. So let's see how good it is. So here is the series that I was talking about, and here are the partial sums. These are just the partial sums of the series. So if you take one term in the series, you get one. Take two terms in the series, you get one minus a half, which is a half. If you take three terms, you get one minus a half, plus a third, which is 0.8333, and so on, and you continue going. And I want you to look at the partial sums. These partial sums are very, very slowly converging, and they're oscillating about the correct answer. You know what the correct answer is. Log of 2 is 0.693, okay? And so here's much greater than 693, below it, below it, but above it, and so on. And they're oscillating, and they're nowhere near it. And if you were to just add up the series, which is the dumbest thing you can possibly do with the series, you will never get the sum of the series. Here are the first terms in the Shanks table. Okay, this is just after one Shanks, and you notice how much closer it is to 0.693. In fact, the very first term in the series is 0.7. Fantastic, okay? Now, these numbers are also oscillating, but do you notice that from just seven terms in the series, just seven terms, I already see the number 0.693. I'm oscillating. Here's just above 693, just below. Look at that. So now I do another, I put another column in the Shanks table. I take the Shanks of the partial sums, and look at this. Now, the correct answer is 693.1472, and I have 0.69314. So I have the first five digits correctly from just the first eight terms in the series. So the series, all we're doing is coaxing the answer out of the series. The series knows what the answer is, but it's a very nasty thing. It doesn't want to tell you. So you massage the series, and you say, nice, nice. And it tells you. So here, I've made the Shanks of the Shanks of the Shanks. And I want you to look at the answer now. Look at this, 0.693.1467. And the correct answer is 693.1472. So from just this many terms in the series, I am off by five parts. Okay, in 6 million. So my accuracy is better than one part in a million. Okay, now you understand, had you done the obvious thing, which is just to calculate these partial sums, you could have done it all night long and you would have never gotten an answer that was this accurate. Never. It's absolutely incredible. Okay, let me see. Now you had a question. Yes.
It took me something like 10 million terms to get worse than 693.1467.
Good. Okay, so you added up on your computer 10 million terms.
Yeah.
And how many places accuracy?
I think I got four. But
four places.
Yeah. Oh, no, like the four.
You got this four, so you got five places.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then
okay, but you see that the answer was there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of fluff in the series. Okay, a lot of useless junk that we don't care about, and we're trying to extract the answer from that series. Okay, now here we're looking just at elementary problems, but when we do Fourier series, you're going to see how serious this is. Series. You just go to series and Roebuck and you buy one off the shelf. So you can see this converges very rapidly. Let's look at another example, which is even worse. Okay. Now, this series, when you talk about slowly converging series, this is one of the worst series you can imagine, because it converges even more slowly, much more slowly, than this series. Okay. And that's because instead of adding up the reciprocals of the integers, alternating with the alternating signs, I'm adding up the reciprocals of the square roots of the integers. Now, these square roots here, this is clearly a convergent series. By the way, just make sure that you're on the same page. Why does this series converge? Say it again. And something. Right. Okay, so what you are giving me is the alternating series test. Okay, and the alternating series test says the following. If you have a series of terms that alternate in sign, real numbers that alternate in sign, and monotonically go to zero, the partial sums always oscillate above and below and above and below. The partial sums are form an oscillatory sequence of decreasing amplitude, okay? And therefore, the series must converge. And you're right, okay? So you've given me the reason. So this series converges. It doesn't converge to an interesting number, but it converges to this number, 0.6048986. If you were to add up on your computer and run, well, all night long, you would never get a useful answer to the sum, for the sum of the series. Never, because it's so slowly converging. And you can see that these oscillations are huge. You can see this, right? 1, and then all the way down to 0.3, and back to 0.87, and down to 0.3, and up to 0.8, and down to 0.4, and so on. This is a very, very, very slowly converging thing. But if you form a Shanks table, I want you to notice here that just from the first 7 terms here in this series, here I am of talking about the Shanks of the Shanks of the Shanks. Okay? And here is the answer that I'm getting, 0.6049003. Okay, instead of 0.6048986. Okay, so we have a fantastic amount of accuracy. And of course, if we were to go further, if we were to go, say, down to the 30th partial sum, we would have such accuracy that we couldn't even begin to make use of that much accuracy. We'd have, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50 decimal places, that sort of thing. Yeah?
The Shanks only work for alternating series.
Yes. So actually, no. It is constructed for alternating series, and it works best for alternating series. But if you have a series that isn't quite alternating, suppose it's a little bit noisy. It might go plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, something like this. Or it might not even alternate. It still doesn't hurt to try a Shanks. You look at the answer. Okay? So there's a little bit of black magic here. What is happening here, okay, and you can read about this, what is happening is that the Shanks is moving the singular, there, why does the series diverge or have a slow convergence? The answer is because there are singularities in the complex plane that are near the origin that are preventing the series from converging. What this Shanks transformation really does is move those singularities further out in the complex plane. It moves them away. And the singularities that are controlling the slow convergence of the series are being pushed further away. That's what's happening. That's the reason for this black magic stuff. Okay. All right. So this is the first thing I wanted to show you. And the second technique, well, let's start. Second technique is called Richardson extrapolation. This is, you said you took a computer course and you talked about Richardson. You all did. Okay. So Richardson extrapolation is also a technique for making a sequence converge, a sequence of partial sums. So again, you start with a sequence that looks like this, of partial sums, and you want it to get to the answer faster. Except in this case, the sequence is a monotone sequence. So again, what does Mr. Richardson say? He says, let's make a model. Let's just make a model. So let's assume that the sequence Sn has the form of A, which is the sum, you know, which is the limit of the sequence, plus, say, B over N, plus C over N squared, plus D over N cubed, and so on. Okay? That's just a model. Okay? Now, this model may well be incorrect. It could be that the sequence of partial sums doesn't have this form. It might have the form A plus B over the square root of N, plus C over N, plus D over N to the 3/2. It could have that form. But the most likely structure is this. Okay? And so let's make a model. We'll just assume that this is true. Then the point is we don't care about B, C, D, E. We don't care about those numbers. The number we care about is the number A. That's what we care about. OK? okay? Because in the limit as n goes to infinity, that is what this sequence S sub n converges to. So what should we do? Well, let's have some fun. Let's throw away everything in the sequence beyond B, just for starters. So for our model, we will say Sn is equal to A plus B over n. In other words, the assumption that we're making is that n is so big that we can just throw away these terms because they're small. They're divided by high powers of n. Okay? Now, there are two unknowns in the sequence. Therefore, I need two equations to find two unknowns, just like Richardson. So let's take the next number in the sequence. It has this form. And now we want to solve for A. So how will we solve for A? We've got to get rid of B. How do we get rid of B? Let's take the first equation. This is really trivial algebra. Okay, I mean, this is kid stuff. But let's multiply by n. So we have n Sn is equal to A times n plus B. Take this, multiply by n plus 1, you get n plus 1 times Sn plus 1 is equal to A times n plus 1 plus B. Agreed? Now, subtract the top equation from the bottom equation, and what you get is n plus 1 times Sn plus 1 minus n times Sn is equal to A. And that's the formula. Right? That's it. Pretty simple. Okay? Let's do a slightly more, I don't want to bore you to tears, but let's do a slightly more complicated calculation. What happens if we throw away everything after C, but we include C? Okay, so this is a slightly more accurate calculation. All right? So now we have three unknowns, A, B, and C. We don't care about B and C. We only care about A. But what should we do? Well, we're going to need three equations. The first equation I get by multiplying through by n. So I have n, in fact, let me multiply through by n squared so that I can isolate C, okay? So I get n squared times Sn is equal to n squared A plus nB plus C, okay? You see the structure that is developing here. Let's take the next equation. We're going to need two more equations. Next equation would read n plus 1 squared times Sn plus 1 is equal to n plus 1 squared times A plus n plus 1 times B plus C. And let's take the next equation, which is n plus 2 squared Sn plus 2 equals n plus 2 squared times A plus n plus 2 B plus C. Now let's be a little bit clever. We don't care about B and we don't care about C. And we want A. So this is what I suggest. Let's take the top equation and multiply it by 1, the middle equation and multiply it by minus 2, and the third equation and multiply it by 1. I wonder if you're noticing those are binomial coefficients. And we'll add them up. Okay, now if we add them up, on the left-hand side, we get n plus 2 squared Sn plus 2 minus 2 n plus 1 squared Sn plus 1 plus Sn. Okay, now let's see what happens when we multiply it up, when we combine these equations. You see that we have a plus C here and a plus C here and a minus 2C. They cancel out. Okay. Then for this term, for the middle term, the B terms, they also have to cancel out. Do you see that? Okay. Why is it that they are really, why are they canceling out? Does anybody understand What's happening? There's something going on here. Yeah, do you see what's happening?
Second derivative of...
Beautiful. You're absolutely right. Very, very good. Very good. If I... So, do you... If you know anything a little bit about... A tiny bit about discrete mathematics, if I have a sequence a sub n, okay, this is like a function f of x. Okay? This is the discrete version of continuous. If I take a derivative f prime of x, that is like taking the first difference, namely a sub n plus 1 minus a sub n. That's the first difference corresponds to the first derivative. If I want to calculate f prime prime of x, that would be the first difference of the first difference, which would be a n plus 2 minus 2 a n plus 1 plus a n. Okay? So this is the second difference, which corresponds to the second derivative. But the second derivative of x is 0. Okay? And you notice that this is linear in n. So the second derivative of something linear must vanish. Of course, you can work it out and you'll see it. But you can see the point here. The only question, so the only thing that remains is a. But a, it won't be 1 times a. What do you get if you take the second derivative of x squared? You get 2, right? So if you just work it out, the n squared terms cancel, the n terms cancel. And what I'm left with is 2, just 2, okay? And so I have to divide by 2. And that is equal to a. And you can see by now, you should be able to see the pattern completely. If you want to calculate, if you want to use 3 terms, if you want to take 2 equations, you've got this formula. If you use 3 equations, you've got that formula. The next formula would give you a is equal to n plus 3 cubed times Sn plus 3 minus 3 times n plus 2 cubed times Sn plus 2 plus 3 times n plus 1 cubed times Sn plus 1 minus n cubed times Sn, all divided by what? 3 factorial. That's right, 3 factorial. And that, you can see, this is the general form. Okay, so this is called, if you like, the first Richardson, R1. And this is the second Richardson, R2. And this is the third Richardson, R3. And the nth Richardson is kind of obvious. Okay, and the question is, what have I done here? Well, once again, when you perform a Richardson, you get a new sequence. So the nth Richardson of a sequence gives you a new sequence. That new sequence is not a constant unless the sequence has exactly the form that I've put in this model. But you're going to see that the sequence that you end up with is a very, very, very slowly varying sequence, much, much closer to its limiting value. And let me show you what the answers look like. So here is the Richardson of this sequence. Okay, and what I have done here, so I said before that if you add up the reciprocals of the squares of the integers, it converges to pi squared over 6. And pi squared over 6 is 1.644934, blah, blah, blah. This is the exact answer, OK? If you were interested in calculating pi, for example, using this formula here to calculate pi, you know, it's an interesting idea. You can calculate pi using this formula. If you tried to do it by just adding up these numbers, it would be the dumbest thing you could possibly do. Just don't even think about doing that, OK? On the other hand, if you just folded in the notion of Richardson and you added up these numbers, what would you see? Well, if you do this is n equals 2 means the Richardson of, in this table, it's the Richardson of three terms. Okay, so it's really, it's this term right, it's this right here. Okay, that's what I mean by n equals 2, so I'm sorry about that. This is the two more Richardsons, this is two more Richardsons. What I want you to notice is the accuracy. If you start with the very first term in the series, and you just use the next six, use starting at 1, you just use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, S1, S2, S3, S4, S5, S6, and you construct the Richardson, what you get is this, 1.644935. So you're off by one part in a million. Already, the first six terms in the series know the answer. Okay? If you don't do any Richardsons at all, you're nowhere near the answer. Okay? But here, look at this. Look how close you are. And if you start, for example, at the 15th term in the series, so this is, you don't need a computer for this. This is a pencil and paper calculation. You know, if you were on a marooned on a desert island and you needed to calculate pi accurate to one part in a trillion, no problem. You could do it. Just writing in the sand. Okay? So look at the accuracy. And here, starting with the 25th term in the series, and using six terms altogether, the 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th, and 30th term of the partial sums, you can get the answer accurate to one part in a trillion. Okay, which is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So the series knows what the limit is supposed to be. Okay? All right, so I hope I've sold you on the fact that we can extract answers from series that we need to sum very, very efficiently. Let me make a remark, because you may have, I don't know what you studied in your course, but did you learn about the connection between Richardson and Romberg integration? You did? Ha! Huh. Wonderful. Oh, this is really an organized, it wasn't intentionally organized, just happened to turn out that way. Okay, so there is a nice application to numerical integration. How does Romberg integration work? Okay, if you wanted to numerically to calculate the integral of a function, okay, you could use a fairly rapidly convergent method. Okay, but there are very fancy, very high-powered methods of evaluating an integral. One of them is called Gaussian quadrature, but another one is called Romberg integration. In fact, Simpson's rule is just the first Richardson of the trapezoid rule. And what is Romberg integration? Romberg integration is really wonderful. What you do is you say, I want to evaluate the integral of a function f of x. So I introduce a lattice. And of course, I could use Simpson's rule. But who cares about Simpson's rule? We don't need a rapidly converging rule. We'll just use, say, the trapezoid rule. OK? Now, what I do is I take 100. So I have some function here, da 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 da. And I want to find the area under this curve, OK, as an integral. So what do? I introduce a lattice having 100 points in it, and I use the trapezoid rule. Is this going to give me an accurate answer? Of course not. It's going to give you a crappy answer. Okay. Now, I do it again with 200 points. Okay. Then I do it again with 400 points. And then I do it again with 800 points, and so on. Well, if you do that, your answers are going to be very poor. I mean, you won't get an accurate answer using the trapezoid rule until you've used millions of points, trillions maybe of points. Okay? Only then will your answer be very accurate. But we don't need to use trillions of points. We'll just use 100 points, 200 points, 400 points, and then we'll let Richardson extrapolation tell us how that answer, what that answer is approaching. We may be nowhere near the answer, but if we then use Richardson extrapolation, we will get the answer with fantastic accuracy. That's the reason why Romberg integration is so powerful. Was that taught to you? It was. Oh, terrific. This is called spiral learning or something like that. That's great. Okay. So what I would like to do is give you an overview of the course that I'm teaching you so far. And I think that's a pretty adequate overview. Okay. Now, what I'd like to do, I want to do some more. Okay, good. So let's do a more serious calculation. What I want to talk about is Fourier series, and to motivate the use of Fourier series, Fourier series are used to solve differential equations. Now, almost all differential equations cannot be solved in closed form. And when you took an elementary differential equations course, after you studied the very, very small number of differential equations that you can solve exactly, what you learned is the natural thing to do if you have a hard differential equation to solve. And by the way, you need to learn how to solve differential equations because virtually all physical principles are expressed in the form of a differential equation. Everything from quantum field equations, the Schrodinger equation, Maxwell's equation, doesn't matter. They're all Schrodinger equations. That's how you express, how you describe a physical theory. You need to solve these equations. So you learn that if you have a hard differential equation, you use a series. So let me give you an example of a hard differential equation. Say y prime is equal to cosine of xy. This is a very, very difficult differential equation. It's only a first-order differential equation, but I'll give you a prize if you can solve it analytically in closed form. It's a very, very, very difficult differential equation. I can solve any differential equation of the form y prime is a function of, say, x plus y, or x minus y, or y over x. Okay, any of those differential equations are very easy to solve. But a function of x times y, this is very, very difficult. So there's no hope of solving this problem analytically. But it's only a first-order differential equation. And suppose I give you an initial condition, say y of 0 equals 1. Then you know that a solution exists, okay? And all you have to do is find it. And there is a standard procedure that you're taught in an elementary differential equations course about how to go about doing it. And what do? You use a Taylor series. So you assume that y of x has the form, well, what would be the first term in the Taylor series? Say it again. 1. And that's very nice, because the first term in this Taylor series is 1. And that incorporates the initial condition right away. So this is really terrific. Okay, you've already used this fact by assuming the solution in the form of a Taylor series. And then you write down the next terms, ax plus bx squared plus cx cubed plus dx to the fourth, and so on. Okay? Now, all you need to do is to plug this into the differential equation and compare powers of x. In fact, what we're doing is a special case of what I taught you last time, I don't think I actually taught it to you, but what I told you about, and that's just perturbation theory. Okay? So on the left side of the equation, you put down the derivative. The derivative of this would be a plus 2bx plus 3cx squared plus 4dx cubed, and so on. Okay? And on the right-hand side, you plug in cosine of x times this series. Okay? Now that's a little bit complicated, right? It's cosine of x times this series, x times that series, but it's really not so bad because cosine, we're assuming here that x is small, right? We're treating x as being small here. And because there's an x in here, it means the argument of the cosine is very, very small, right? So therefore, the expansion of cosine for small argument, let's write it down. Cosine for small argument is 1 minus epsilon squared over 2 plus epsilon to the 4th over 4 factorial and so on, right? So the right-hand side of this equation is 1. And then we have minus 1 half of this thing squared, OK? So when you square x, you get x squared. And if you square this thing, now on the left side of the equation, I only have 3 powers of x. So if I square this, I don't care about this because they're already 2. Okay, there's 2 powers of x. And if I square this, I will have 4 powers, so I don't care about that. So I'll just square this, and I get a squared plus 4abx, and so on. Oh, sorry. Crap. Looking at the wrong one. This. I get 1 plus 2ax plus more terms, OK? And so the equation that I get on the right-hand side is 1 minus 1 half x squared minus the 2's cancel, just a x cubed, and so on. OK? All right? Is that good? And now I just look at the left side of this equation and the right side of the equation and use the fact that the coefficients of a Taylor series are unique. And the first thing I see is that the constant term here, a, is equal to 1, so a equals 1. There is no x term on the right-hand side, so b equals 0. There's an x squared term, so 3c equals minus 1 half. There's a 4d. 4d is equal to minus a, and so on. So by introducing a Taylor series, I've reduced the differential equation down to absolute trivia, just trivial algebraic equations. This tells me that c is minus 1/6 and d is minus a over 4. But we just said a is 1, so that's 1 over 4, and so on. Okay. And we have a Taylor expansion of the solution. And this is great. There's no problem here. So that's fine. We can use Taylor series to solve differential equations. Well, wait a minute. Ordinary differential equations are not usually what we use to describe a physical theory. Usually, a physical theory is described by a partial differential equation. So what's an example of a partial differential equation? Let's take, yeah?
So this equation, we assume that x is small, which means that our solution is not valid for all our space, right? It's supposed to be valid for that.
That's right. So we're assuming here that x is small. If the differential equation, as this differential equation is, if the differential equation is linear, we do not have to worry. If the differential equation, as this equation is nonlinear, then there may be spontaneous singularities that appear. Okay? And that means that we do not know before we begin, we do not know what the radius of convergence of the series is going to be. And it may be that eventually x gets too big to use a Taylor series. And at that point, we have to stop. Okay, the Taylor series is no longer valid. But before we begin, we don't know. However, we are guaranteed that there is some region, because this is a continuous function of x, you know, because it satisfies the Lipschitz condition of for the existence and uniqueness of solutions. This satisfies the Lipschitz condition. And therefore, we know that there exists a neighborhood in which the Taylor series does work. Where it stops working, we don't know. Okay, and that's because this is a very non-trivial problem. I made it look simple, but this is really a very, very, very non-trivial. It's also, by the way, an extraordinarily interesting problem. But I won't talk about it. If you're interested, I'll tell you separately, privately. That's because this equation has remarkable stabilities and instabilities, and it has a separatrix structure, and it's a really remarkable equation. But I just showed you how to get the answer. So the question is, do Taylor series work for partial differential equations? And let's try a really simple example of a partial differential equation. Let's take the equation ut plus ux equals 0. Okay? By the way, I hope you all know a subscript t means, you know, u sub t means du dt. Okay? This is the standard notation for partial derivatives. What is this equation? Just to make sure we're all on the same page. What kind of equation is this? Good. It's a wave equation. And let's write down the solution. The solution to this equation is u is a function of x minus t. That's right. Very good. And can you tell me what this represents? That's right. So at t, so this is u of x and t, and at t equals 0, u of x and 0 is f of x. So the meaning of f of x is this is the shape of the wave at time 0. And this wave moves to the right. So the wave might look like that. It moves to the right. And at this, in this case, it's moving at the speed 1. If I had put in here a constant c, the speed of light, then this wave would be moving at the wave speed c. Okay, but never mind. C is 1. Okay? Now, that's what the solution is. There we go. Now, let's see if we can solve. Suppose you didn't know what the solution to this equation was, but you understood Taylor series. You'd say, let me try to solve this equation using a Taylor series. It's obvious. I mean, that's the only thing we know how to do. Let's do it. Okay? From our course in ordinary differential equations. So you would say the following. You would say, let's express u of x and t as a series of the as a Taylor series in the form, let's say, a sub n of x times t to the n. And furthermore, if this is my initial condition, how did we, you remember, we incorporated the initial condition immediately in the Taylor series before we even looked at the differential equation. So if my initial condition is that u of x and 0 is some function f of x, then I know that a 0 is f of x. And I have now incorporated my initial condition. Right? And now all we have to do is take this Taylor series, differentiate it, and plug it into the problem, compare coefficients, and we're done. Right? It's very straightforward. So let's take the time derivative. Now, you notice this is a series in powers of t. And when I take a time derivative, the 0th term contains no t. So that when I take a time derivative, it goes away. And I have the sum from n equals 1 to infinity, a sub n of x times n times t to the n minus 1. Okay? And when I take a space derivative, that gives me the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n prime of x times t to the n. And the differential equation says that this is 0. And since the right-hand side is a Taylor series, all of whose coefficients are 0, the left-hand side must be a Taylor series, all of whose coefficients must be 0. Except we don't want to compare peaches and apples. This is t to the n, and that's t to the n minus 1. But we can fix that. Let's just shift n here upward. So we just replace n by n plus 1. But of course, we have to compensate by shifting the endpoint downward. Okay? So in place of this, I will write the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, then a sub n plus 1 of x, n plus 1, t to the n. Okay? Now, the coefficient of t to the n is precisely a sub n plus 1 times n plus 1. And that's equal to minus a sub n prime of x. Right? Now I'm going to do something you should never do when you're teaching. It's a terrible blackboard technique. So I'm going to erase this and divide it. When you all become professors, don't ever do that. Never. OK, so this tells me the formula for the next A in terms of the previous A. And now let's just look at what we've got. We know that A0 is f of x. A1 is obtained by changing the sign, dividing by 1, and taking a derivative. So A1 is minus f prime of x. And A2 is, change the sign again, plus f prime prime of x and divide by 2. And it'll be 2 factorial. And A3 is minus f triple prime over 3 factorial, right? And so on. So it's clear, it's absolutely clear what this is. If I just plug this in, I get u of x and t is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n over n factorial times t to the n times f n derivatives of x. OK? Is that so? We've finished the calculation. And now, what is that? What is this here? What is that? This is just f of x plus t. It is merely the Taylor of x minus t. This is merely the Taylor expansion of the function f of x minus t. So we solved, using Taylor series, a partial differential equation. This looks great until we think about it. What's the criticism of this? There is a serious criticism here. Yeah?
It only works if f has a Taylor series?
Right. In fact, there's absolutely no reason why the function f of x has to have a Taylor series. Absolutely no reason. In fact, there's no reason why f even has to have one derivative, not even one. For example, this function f of x could look like this. You can have a triangular wave. There's nothing wrong physically with a triangular wave. And it could move along like this at the speed 1. And if this were true, this calculation I did is all nonsense. So let me emphasize the point even more strongly. Let me give you a really good example of the failure of Taylor series. It is remarkable that Taylor series are wonderful for ordinary differential equations. But for partial differential equations, they're terrible. Absolutely terrible. And this is the example that I think will illustrate the point even more forcefully. What's that equation? This is the heat equation. It describes diffusion, OK? And diffusion is one of the 3 fundamental processes in physics that we use, in continuum physics, that we use differential equations to represent. That's diffusion. This is the heat diffusion equation. The other two equations, one of them is, what are the other two equations? The wave equation, which describes propagation. OK, and the typical second order wave equation is UTP equals UXX. And the wave equation describes propagation. What's the third equation? Laplace's equation. And that describes, it describes equilibrium. OK, it describes a potential, but more generally, it describes, there are 3 fundamental physical processes, OK? Equilibrium, propagation, and diffusion. And those are the 3 equations that describe these processes. Let's look at the wave equation. The wave equation, yeah?
That our solution is separable.
Like, say it again?
You wrote the solution, like, the solution of u as can be separated, right?
Separated.
Separated as a product of two functions, of t, the function of a and x and the function of t.
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
What I'm saying is the solution u of t for this question, you just assume that it can be separated like that.
I didn't didn't separate anything.
As in terms of x and in terms of t.
I didn't. Where did I do that? Oh, you mean here?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the structure of a Taylor series. I assumed that. I looked for a Taylor series in powers of t. Why in powers of t? Because the first term in this series, the very first term, is the initial condition. That's why I wanted a Taylor series in t. I want to evolve in t, because when t is equal to 0, I get a 0, which is given as f of x. So I could incorporate my initial condition. I wouldn't want a Taylor series in powers of x, because then I can't incorporate any initial condition. Okay? It's natural to use a Taylor series in t, and that's what generalizes from ordinary differential equations. Okay? So let's take an initial condition that u of x and 0 is some function f of x again, and let's solve the problem. And let's just do it very quickly. Let's assume that u of x and t is a sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n of x times t to the n. Exactly the same thing I did before. Okay? And a 0 of x is f of x. So I have incorporated the initial condition right away at the beginning of the problem. Right? Is that clear? Now, what will I do here? Let me simply take this and plug it into the differential equation. Okay? The differential equation is this differential equation. Okay? So on the left, I take the time derivative, and that gives me the sum from n equals 0, n equals 1, to infinity, a sub n of x times n times t to the n minus 1. Okay? And I take two space derivatives. That's the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n prime prime of x, t to the n. I then shift exactly as I did before with the wave equation, and I get the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n plus 1, n plus 1, times t to the n. I take the coefficient of t to the n, and I learn that a sub n plus 1 is equal to a sub n prime prime over n plus 1. That's the solution. So I can write down the solution to the heat equation right away. Okay, and the solution is u of x and t. So you see what this is saying. Let's write down the first few. A0 is f of x. A1 is equal to f prime prime of x over 1. A2 is f prime 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 of x over 2 factorial, and so on. Right? So the solution to the heat equation is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n is f 2n derivatives divided by n factorial times t to the n. And that must be the solution to the heat equation. Okay? So we did it. We solved the problem. It's right there. There's the answer in the form of a Taylor series. But what I want to argue is that this, what I did, is junk. And I want to argue it in two ways. First, I want to argue, suppose f of 0 is e to the minus x squared. Okay? Suppose the initial distribution of heat is just a Gaussian that looks like that. Now, you know what is going to happen. This is going to diffuse, right? So at a later time, it will look like this, and then it'll look like this. The heat will spread out to infinity. Is that right? You all know this. All right. This is f of x. Okay, this is u of x and 0. Okay? Great. So let's take this and plug it in here. And in particular, let me calculate for you u of 0 and t. Okay? So I'm going to calculate the temperature at the position 0, but at time t, just by plugging into that equation. Now, e to the minus x squared, you know what that is. That is minus 1 to the n times x to the 2n over n factorial. And if I take two n derivatives, that's what I'm supposed to do. Take two n derivatives. And if I take these two n derivatives and set x equal to 0, I will get 2n factorial. Agreed? Right? So u of x and u of 0 and t is the sum from n equals 0 to infinity minus 1 to the n, 2n factorial divided by this n factorial and divided by this n factorial times t to the n. Now, how does this series behave for large n? Does the series converge or not? Does this converge or does it not converge? Let's see. Well, you know that n factorial behaves like n to the n times e to the minus n, roughly. Okay, and this is the Stirling approximation for n factorial. So therefore, the nth term in this series behaves roughly like minus 1 to the n. 2n factorial would be 2n to the 2n power times e to the minus 2n times t to the n here. And in the denominator is n to the n e to the minus n and n to the n e to the minus n. Okay, did you follow all that? You know the Stirling approximation. So here we have n to the n and n to the n, which is n to the 2n, so it cancels that. And we have e to the minus n and e to the minus n and e to the minus 2n, so that cancels. So this is roughly minus 1 to the n, 4 to the n, t to the n. All right? So this is approximately a series of that form. What is the radius of convergence of that series? Say it again. 1/4. So this converges for t less than 1/4. What? Are you telling me that something happened? Now, you know that when you pass the radius of convergence of a series, there is some physical change, some abrupt change. There is something that happens in this problem. What happens at t equals 1/4? I thought that if you take an initial distribution of heat, it just continues to smoothly spread out. But it's not. Something happens. This series begins to diverge at t equals 1/4. Why? Does anybody know? Yes?
Inflection points.
No, this couldn't be a nicer, smoother function. Something is going wrong. This is a Taylor expansion, and that's the radius. So what went wrong? Nobody knows? Where does a Taylor series converge? It converges in a circle. It's not that something went wrong at t equals 1/4. Nothing went wrong. What went wrong was at t equals minus 1/4. What happens at t equals minus 1/4? You said the answer, except you said it using sign language. Yes, what is the answer?
There is a delta function.
There is, that's right. The point is, if we try to undiffuse, which is physically not allowed because entropy has a direction, right? This is spreading because this is the arrow of time. This is entropy. But if we force this equation to go backward in time by using a Taylor series solution, as it goes to earlier and earlier times, times before 0, we can postdict what the distribution of temperature was, and it becomes sharper and sharper and sharper like this, okay? And eventually, at t equals minus 1/4, the solution looks like a spike, like a delta function. And before that, there is nothing, because there isn't anything that evolves, that diffuses, and evolves into a delta function under the diffusion equation. So the problem is, we could not use a Taylor series, because a Taylor series insists on converging in a circle. And we don't want to converge in a circle because that would include negative values of time. Do you understand that? That's the problem with this. So a Taylor series is no good. That is why when we solve the heat equation and when we solve other physical problems, partial differential equations, we do not use Taylor series. Hasn't it ever occurred to you that we ought to use a Taylor series to solve partial differential equations? You use them to solve ordinary differential equations. The reason is because Taylor series always insist on converging in circles and diverging outside of circles. And if something happens, if there's a physical something that happens, the Taylor series ceases to be useful because Taylor series only describe functions that have an infinite number of derivatives. So we need to use a better kind of series. And the kind of series that we are forced to use that will replace the Taylor series and that doesn't converge in circles but converges in regions that we're interested in is a Fourier series. That's the reason why we need to use Fourier series in physics. But what's the problem with Fourier series? Taylor series converge very rapidly, like geometric series. But Fourier series stink because they converge almost, sometimes the convergence rate is so slow that you can never sum up a Fourier series. What I'm going to show you is that we can sum a Fourier series, and we can extract the answer from a Fourier series. And this justifies the use of using Fourier series. This is justifying Fourier series in the solution of physical problems. So next time, I'm going to talk to you about how to do such a thing. Okay? All right.